Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we're taking a breath during a wild summer of blockbusters and noise and starting with something a little more calming, the acclaimed cartoon series, Steven Universe. Then we'll continue breathing deeply through this sweaty season with a chat about some of the board and card games we have won, lost, and never loved at all. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Hey, it's Robert and Stacey from the Planet Money team. You know, a lot of places report on the oil business.
But we got into the oil business.
We bought 100 barrels of crude oil in Kansas. We shipped it, we refined it, and we got it to your gas tank.
Check it out on the next few episodes of Planet Money.
You can find us on iTunes or NPR One.
It's games and cartoons on this week's show, but before we get started here in semi-historic Studio 45, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And with us this week are two of our favorite guests. Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and a producer with Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I'm one of the co-hosts of the Code Switch podcast.
That's right, you sure are. You know, we're on a little bit of a summer vacation show here. By the time you hear this is going to be a couple weeks after we taped it because I'm going to be away watching all the new television. Mm-hmm. We're in here with our special pals, Gene and Kat. Glenn is off gallivanting at Comic-Con. As we tape this, we're in a different studio. Basically, we decided to have class outside.
That's right. Yes.
by which we meant down the hall.
Yep.
In a different studio. So a lot of times what we cover here is current TV, current movies, stuff we're reading about and we're listening to, as we say in the intro. But sometimes we like to take a step back and visit with some sort of cultural property that's a little more interesting than it is immediate. And one of the ones a lot of people have asked us to take a look at is Steven Universe. Cartoon Network launched it in 2013. It's an animated series created by Rebecca Sugar, who's also written for Adventure Time. Steven Universe is a half-human, half-gem, and a gem in this universe is a little like a superhero. It's getting complicated already. So maybe to get into this, I want to go to our Steven Universe super fan in the group. Now is Gene Demby. Hey, buddy. So Steven Universe, he is a kid, half human, half... Am I right in saying sort of a
right.
superhero?
He's half human, half gem. As you said, they're super-powered aliens. They all have sort of different power sets. They're all named after...
Gems.
Yeah. Minerals and gems.
Yeah.
But there are recurring abilities that they all have, right? Like shapeshifting.
But they can all sort of summon right. weapons. But the show is not really about the fighting.
No.
It's about sort of them loving each other.
Right. Because like a lot of really cool current television, mm-hmm. it's a show about an unusual family.
That's exactly right.
And so because Steven has a father who is human,
Steven Thompson.
we were going to need Steven's, to find
somewhere. Steven Thompson also had a human father. But Steven Universe has a human father who's around.
Mm-hmm. He's a former rock musician who lives in a band.
And he's around.
Wow,
and
that
he's
so elaborate.
And he's loving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But really, Steven Universe spends a lot of his time with his family of, I don't know, sister's moms, kind of.
Sort of. Yeah, they're like his play pals, but also his guardians.
Mentors.
Yeah.
It's three gems that he lives with.
Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl. And so they are both teaching him how to be a gem. They are full gems. He is only half gem.
Right.
And first, they don't explain a lot of the
right.
world, the universe right. in which Steven Universe plays out
yeah,
in.
Yeah, it's a little confusing for me as someone who hasn't really watched it that much.
Yeah,
but this is helpful.
Well, they start fairly slowly.
Right, they do, right. And the episodes are 11 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And so every episode, they'll give you a little bit of this is the world.
Mythology.
They have. And so by the time you get a couple dozen episodes in, which won't take very long because they're 11 minutes long,
right.
you end up having a much bigger sense of basically the scope of the complicated mythology that they inhabit and why Steven is important. But also, the thing that made me so fascinated by the show is the way it plays with gender. We can get to that a little bit later.
No, but, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's fair to say. So Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl are all women or present as women gems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Garnet is super tall and super skinny
right.
and black.
Mm-hmm.
And
she's voiced by Estelle.
Estelle. Yeah. Oh, one of my favorite voice performances I've heard in such a long time.
Absolutely.
It's
yeah.
so sedate and mm-hmm. elegant in this way.
Howdy.
What you up to, Garnet?
I was just at the bottom of the ocean checking for signs of lapis and jasper.
Any luck?
Nope.
Wow. How were you able to swim to the bottom of the ocean?
It was easy. I'm a really good swimmer.
I love that performance. And then Amethyst is kind of like a rounder, curvier, short gem. And then Pearl is like a super skinny, but like more of the rail thin.
Rail thin, like kind of responsible fuss budget.
And one of the things that I've read a lot of people talk about with this show is how much they appreciate the fact that they all have really different bodies. Like they all are cartoon bodies. But they're all really different kind of types.
And all of the gems have relationships to each other, right? Specific orientations to each other. And to Steven as well, right? And so, like, it feels as if, to your point about family, right? We all have different relationships to different members of our family at different times. It definitely feels like each of these characters were written to have a specific orientation to each other based on their personality. That also gets deepened as the show goes on.
Yeah, because Garnet is sort of unflappable and...
Oh, man. I'm going to want to talk about Garnet.
Yeah.
What do you want to say about Garnet?
Okay, so first of all, this is a show that my 12-year-old daughter loves. And one of the things that she's an anime fan, and I think the incredibly complicated nature of the plot is very appealing to her. The sheer number of characters that accumulate over the course of the show allows her to speak about this show to me in a way that she thinks I understandably thinks I won't understand. So it has an element of like, gotta catch them all. There are so many of these characters. We just talked about Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl in part because they are the main gems in the first few episodes.
In the theme song.
And in the theme song. And over the course of time, they've added Peridot, and they've added more and more gems, and this very, very complex plot about who is in opposition to the gems, and
it has a pretty complex mythology by now.
The mythology just builds and builds and builds. There's this whole thing with like an anthropomorphized French fry container that goes berserk. You skip around, and there's an episode right at the end of the first season, and the first season is 52 11-minute episodes. And right at the end, there's an episode called Jailbreak. The gems, including Steven, are all in this prison. And you have two gem characters that are separate from each other, and they introduce one without saying who she is. And she is looking for a gem named Sapphire.
Okay.
And Sapphire is singing to her, in part so they can locate each other. And when they finally meet, Sapphire calls out to Ruby, and you figure out that this character is Ruby and this character is Sapphire. And they meet in this incredibly romantic scene. It is clear that they are in romantic love.
Ruby! Did they hurt you?
No, I'm okay. Did they hurt you?
Who cares?
I do.
And they sort of swirl together. They're Garnet.
Yeah.
Steven! Thank you.
Garnet! You're a fusion?
Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't want you meeting us here like this.
Well, did I make a good first impression?
Oh, Steven. We already love you.
And then Garnet does battle. And as Garnet, she is way stronger than she is as each of these individual characters. And she's able to do the kind of battle that needs to be done once these two characters have become one.
And the song she sings is amazing.
And the song that she sings, and they have a performer doing her voice. And the song is all about basically like how much strength these people draw from being together.
Yeah.
The two of us ain't gonna follow your rules. Come at me without any of your fancy tools. Let's go, just me and you. Let's go, just one on two. Go ahead and try and hit me if you're able. Can't you see that my relationship is stable? I can see you hate the way we intermingle. But I think you're just mad cause you're single. And you're not gonna stop what we made together. We are gonna stay like this forever. If you break us apart, we'll just come make you up. And we'll always be twice the gem that you were.
It's really unbelievably beautiful.
It's beautiful.
Great. Wow. You did great, dude.
That's a good description that makes me want to watch it. So I have a question. As somebody who is very new to Steven Universe, and we were kind of talking about how all the gems are maybe gendered or racialized. So for Garnet specifically, like, do they say that she is black, or is that something we just interpret?
It is definitely to my knowledge, it's just my interpretation.
Yeah,
but it's, to me, the styling of her, in addition to, like, the fact that she has brown skin, but also, like, the styling of her, sure, her head, how do I explain this?
Like,
her,
it's almost like an afro helmet.
It's like an afro
helmet.
I feel like the styling implies it, but it's definitely not. I mean, I don't think they ever say that literally, but I think, I'll say this much. I think if you were a little black girl watching this show, it gives you something different than you would get
if they all
just looked like Pearl, whether or not any of them are specifically, because they're not humans.
Right.
I mean, none of them are black or white or whatever. But if you're looking at what is an image for a kid watching the show, then I think it begins to matter that she's this, that she has brown skin. And as
and
I was saying to Gene and I were trying to explain, it's not hair, it's a helmet.
Square helmet.
If you see her, you'll kind of see what we mean. Well, it's not.
But the other gems are, I mean, I believe at least one of the other gems is voiced by a woman of color as well.
Yeah, so, Pearl is voiced by Dee Dee Magno Hall, who's Filipina.
Yeah.
Well, and there are all these Easter eggs of radical gender expression on this show. And so even in these very early episodes, you watch a character like Amethyst. Mm-hmm. And if you notice, Amethyst usually has some sort of pants on. And at one point, I think she's in shorts and she has hairy legs.
Yeah.
And you don't see a lot of hairy-legged women cartoon characters, especially in such a hyper-stylized show.
Yeah.
And such a, I mean, it's the, like the flagship show on the Cartoon Network.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, the one of the really interesting things about this is for a cartoon series that's 11 minutes long that I think is like loved by kids, it is not, I think of cartoon series as usually incredibly episodic and something that you can kind of dip in and out of, because that's sort of how cartoons always worked in my life. But it's clear that this is intended to be a show that builds and builds and builds on itself, and that the more of the backstory you know, the more you will understand. And so to me, if you are looking to get into this show and you don't want to go back and watch 50 in the first season and however many there have been
since then. It's 52, 26, 26.
So if you don't want to watch that many, I really benefited from looking at some lists of people's favorite episodes. Because a lot of times in a list like that, they'll give you enough background to appreciate it. That was how I stumbled on an episode in which Steven and his... So this idea of fusion is really central to Steven Universe and becomes such a big part of the way they talk about love and the way they talk about people's humanity and the way they talk about commonality. And there's an episode in which Steven and his friend Connie fuse, which they haven't really known whether he was going to be able to do that because he's half human and half gem. And he and his friend Connie fuse... I don't know, Gene, how do I explain this episode?
So is it like platonic? Or?
Well, it's well, at least at that point, it's not really...
Super interesting question. I mean, they're both like adolescent
age. Yeah. 13 or 14, right?
I mean, it's not a hugely sexualized thing, but again, like Steven was saying, it's very loving.
Okay. And we see other characters fuse that have like much more discordant relationships and they can't hold the fuse.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Steven and Connie, who again, just as an aside, human people in the town in which Steven lives is like a really fascinatingly populated world.
Yeah.
Connie's a Tamil. Her parents are Sri Lankan and they're really strict, and so she gets to hang out with Steven. And so she and Steven are really close, even though she's not really supposed to be hanging out with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have this like quiet little teenage... It's not really clear if it's puppy love moment, but they get really close. And they get close and they basically turn into Beyonce. And
is that what happens?
They turn into this like statuesque, this gorgeous woman that everyone is sort of like taken by, right?
Yeah.
And they're sort of fused for the last episode, and you get to see them sort of like navigating their friendship.
Well, here's my question though.
Really?
Is it a statuesque woman or is it
a statuesque
kind of person, fused being?
Sure.
Character is walking around. My read of that is that it's a very gender non-binary logically enough, right?
But you see everyone responding to the character as like clearly like this person is radiant and they're like
everyone is
sort of blushing as
and fascinated men and women fascinated by them. And it's this really interesting, they spend a lot of time trying to figure out like how it feels to be a fused being and the kind of the things that feel great about it and the things that feel kind of weird about it and how you navigate like, do I/we want to do this or this?
Right.
Do we want to fuse?
And then there's, well, yeah.
Do you want to fuse?
Yes. And then there's all this interesting stuff where like, I was going to say Steven's moms. It's not exactly Steven's moms. The gems are kind of have an interesting set of responses to this because on the one hand, they've wanted, like they have sort of hoped that he would prove capable of doing this. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they're very, so they're sort of worried about what it means for him, right. Especially since he's fused with a human. Mm-hmm. They seem to kind of be like, they're excited, but they're also apprehensive mm-hmm. about, like, Garnet has this amazing moment in which she basically says, you're not one person and you're not two people. I think she says, you're an experience.
Huh.
Wow.
And she says, go and have fun mm-hmm. or go and it's something like that. I may be quoting it imperfectly. I'm quoting the effect on my heart. She says, basically, go and have a wonderful time. Just mm-hmm. being like an experience. It's not one person. It's not two people.
I think it's important to speak to the environment in which kids right now are growing up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that kids now are navigating a cultural and sexual landscape that they were not necessarily experiencing when even anyone in this room, even Kat, who is pretty young, necessarily experienced. And I think that gender expression among young kids is very, very... It is a manifestation of a lot of social change,
sure.
And it is a manifestation of what many would call great, great progress. But it is very, very complicated in ways that I don't think adolescence has always been complicated. But I think adolescence now, a lot more kids are coming up assessing things about their gender and their sexuality with an openness and a freedom that previous generations didn't necessarily have. And I think this show is an incredible reflection of that and an embrace of that in a way that I think is going to be extraordinarily powerful for a lot of kids who are going through processes that might seem alien to somebody my age.
That is really well said.
Yeah.
That's really well said.
Yeah.
Steven Universe is the kind of character that could not have existed even, 10 years ago. I mean, he's a boy, right? He's a 14-year-old boy, but like all of his power set is like what we would consider like traditionally feminine, right? He doesn't have any offensive weapons, right? He's a shield. He heals people, and his role in
he's actually like an anime trope of like the magical girl.
The magical girl, right? Yeah, which is a thing I did not know. A good friend of mine, Justin Charity at The Ringer, who is an anime obsessive, was telling me all this stuff. Like when I was telling him that I was watching the show, he was like, there are entire episodes that are just homages to that genre. There's a show called Revolutionary Girl Utena, and apparently there's an episode that is literally like just fan service for this like weird anime show. Uh-huh. Like shows like the magical girl genre is like Sailor Moon, and like there's a teenage
right,
girl
sure.
who is like who has these powers, secret powers, right? And so Steven Universe is that kid, but he's gender swapped, and he's like all of his clothing is pink, and he has a pink jewel in the middle of his stomach, right?
Yeah.
There's all this stuff about just his characterization that is immensely fascinating to me.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff around the fact that he is essentially being trained by these three women.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when I say women, I mean presented by the show, I think, right. very much as women.
Mm-hmm.
He's being essentially raised and protected and trained as a combatant, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to the degree that he's going to go forth and fight and all that stuff. They're the ones who are training him. And mm-hmm. There's also a really interesting episode in which they are kind of trying to figure out how much to support and encourage him and mm-hmm. how much to tell him the truth mm-hmm. about what he's good at and not good at. Mm-hmm. So not only are they getting into tropes around, who's tough and who's not tough and who's offensive and defensive, but they're also really challenging the assumption that these women feel this obligation to be encouraging nurturers all the time. And they're not sure how to balance, like, you could read it as very much a meditation on, like, good mom, like, mm-hmm. ideas about good moms.
Yeah.
Like, how much do you want to just constantly be like, oh, honey, that's great. And it's not that dads don't experience this too, but
sure.
kind of a common cultural trope around the kind of the encouraging mom picking you up off your bike and, like mm-hmm. when you fall down versus trying to make you tough. And
right.
when I first started watching it, I was like, I'm not sure this is for me. Mm-hmm. I just felt a little bit lost, mm-hmm. I think, at the beginning.
I did too.
And I still am far from having gotten to everything that they're getting into thematically. But if you find the right episodes, it's sort of right there
mm-hmm.
where, as Jean said, all the relationships are really specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We didn't even talk about the music, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Talk about the music.
I mean, so the actual theme song itself, there's an extended version of it where they show what becomes the theme song
yeah.
to the gems.
Pizzas, we are the crystal gems. We'll always save the day. And if you think we can't, we'll always That's why the people of this world believe in Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl and Steven.
It always gets me on the show, man.
How? I want to ask you one more question before we get off this topic. I want to ask you, Gene, how did you get into this show?
We were having this conversation on Twitter a couple months ago about how much we loved Avatar: The Last Airbender, and I was like, this is like, I put this up there with like
Legend of Korra,
The Wire, and like as like great American television efforts. And someone, a few people said like you should watch Steven Universe, and I was like, okay. And then earlier this summer, not very long ago, Crystal from The Read was saying like, I really need you guys to watch Steven Universe, and like, everybody in her who replied to her was like, this show makes me cry, especially with everything going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
Like, it's a huge, like, just a respite from...
It's an enormously optimistic.
Absolutely. People were saying like, how queer it was and how, like, and people were just like, this is... Everyone was like, this show is not supposed to be for me, and yet I'm so emotionally attached to it. And I was like, okay, I'll watch it. And so I watched an episode, and it was like 11 minutes, and it just like, the rabbit hole just...
Yeah.
After that suggestion from Crystal, I just went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
If you're thinking of trying this show, I don't necessarily want it to come across like, because it is so thoughtful in so many ways, and because it's doing a lot of, you know, pretty next level stuff socially.
Mm-hmm.
It's not homework.
No, it's not.
This is in many ways this is a very silly cartoon.
It's fun. It's got music.
And the animation style is so gorgeous. The character design on the dad, who is voiced by Tom Sharpling from the best show.
I don't know if I would say the animation style. I think the character design. Is
design.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's the animation is the typical kind of like jerky animation in a way.
Sure.
But as a comic book, it would be gorgeous.
And there are comic books.
Yeah.
I was admiring so quickly, and this felt like, I guess, an homage to maybe Chuck Jones or something, but like the character design on the eyes and the way that the eyes, particularly like Steven will widen his eyes and different shapes will materialize in his eyes. They do a lot of literal stars in his eyes.
Yeah,
it's just so cute.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff. So I want to thank everybody out there who, when we asked for topics, recommended this to us, because I had a great time watching it. And
I'm excited to watch more.
Yeah. I think we all would recommend it. All right. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, it's summertime, so it's hopefully a time when you can grab a little rest here and there. Maybe you do a little game playing. We're going to talk about board games and card games and other stuff you can play without plugging anything in right after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Roadie, the first on-the-way delivery network that connects people who have items to send with drivers heading that way. Roadie is an easy, convenient, and cost-effective way to get door-to-door delivery for items big and small. Roadie lets you track deliveries in real time and offers up to $10,000 in protection on every shipment. Get a free estimate in seconds. Download the Roadie app on iPhone or Android device or visit roadie.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. You know, like our first topic, we're taking our second topic from the realm of listener requests. Now, we had a request to talk about board games and card games. I would point out almost exactly 5 years ago, Pop Culture Happy Hour dabbled in a board game discussion, but it was while I was away, which means we have an almost entirely fresh panel. Now, I do also want to point out there are people who are enthusiasts of this specific thing, which you'll find often traveling under the name tabletop gaming, and of the really kind of current trends in it and the newest stuff, your Will Wheatons, your Rich Summers. But we thought we'd have sort of a generalist's discussion of the world of games. Now, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, I'm going to start by saying, when I was in college, I played a ton of cards.
I know where this is going.
And this is one of the things Gene and I have been talking about on Twitter. So when I was in college, I played a ton of cards.
Mm-hmm.
A ton.
You're trying to shame me.
No, not at all.
Really,
I just think this is interesting. I just thought it was super interesting. I'm more shaming myself in the sense that I had no idea about the thing we're about to talk about. So in my sophomore year of college, I started hanging around with a bunch of people who were crazy card players. And they taught me to play euchre, and they taught me to play a bunch of other stuff. But then they taught me to play spades. And we played an enormous amount of spades when I was in college. I played probably hundreds and hundreds of games of spades, I would say. I remember the spiral notebook that we had that we would just keep the scores, and it was just entirely full of spades scoring. Somewhere those books probably still exist. So, Gene, explain to me how you got into this conversation about spades on Twitter.
Because spades is the kind of thing that you play at a cookout. Like any black gathering of sufficient size, there will be somebody will break out a spades game, right? People have spades parties. And so I went to like all black high school, whatever. And the thing is, like, it gets so intense so young. People become so intense about spades at such a young age. By the time I was in high school and should have been learning how to play spades, like, everyone was like, no, you ain't playing with me. You're not messing up my game. You're not messing with my game. And so I never got a chance to learn. I went to, and with the college, like, can y'all play me? Like, and the same, I mean, like, can you teach me how to play? And they were like, no. Like, you're not messing up my game. So I never learned how to play. And I had to, like, actively, like, seek out.
Did they have YouTube when you were in college? Could you watch tutorials?
No, this is, YouTube is post, it's post college for me. And so, like, you know, there was always a black table on my campus in college. And the people playing spades, I just had to watch. I had no idea what was going on. And so we were talking about this on Twitter. And you were saying that you played all. I was like, oh, wow. So I'm getting my card pulled. By Linda.
Based on my experiences at Oberlin.
Exactly.
It was just funny to me. But part of like what I really did take away from that conversation is like it is such a like it's such a culturally significant thing. Mm-hmm. Because to me, so to you, this is what spades is, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas to me, spades was a kind of less time-consuming alternative to bridge.
Sure.
And obviously, the bridge is a whole different thing with its entirely own kind of cultural deal.
Sure.
But all of these things really do have, I mean, their own very specific places in kind of different people's experience.
Yeah, and it was, we had that conversation in which I came out as a as a non-space player. And then so many people, we found some solidarity. People were like, there are literal dozens of black people who can't play space.
And you're
welcome.
One of them.
I feel like you could start, you could find a local support group that would deal you in.
I could teach you.
My good friend Ramzan, shout out to Ramzan, we went to Chicago a couple weeks ago and sat down with a bunch of folks who sat at a table until very late at night. And we talked a lot of trash and it was glorious.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go.
Do you like it?
Oh no, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And now that I know you can play, I mean now that's I can right. actually we can you and I should set up a table in the cafeteria.
Absolutely. We're doing that. Kat, were you a card player? Have you ever been a card player?
I haven't been a card player, but I mean like growing up my family, like the gatherings were always oriented around games and competition, like mahjong. If you like went to any like Chinese, Cantonese family gathering, there were always tables and tables and sort of like tournament setup. I was actually going to ask you like whether that was a stereotype or whether that was really true.
Maybe my family is stereotypical. No, I mean, for us, it was true. And I actually never learned to play mahjong, but so this is kind of probably like my phase. But mahjong just, it seems so complicated. And that carried on into like my teenage years and adult life in a different way, where every single family gathering that we have, one of my sisters, Stephanie, turns our family gathering into this hyper-competitive tournament that she has themed a certain way, where we're broken up into teams and we have to play all of these different board games that you're not really supposed to play in teams. I know, this is really complicated. Like
which games?
Like, we'll play Kill Dr. Lucky, which is basically like, have you guys played that?
No, that's all.
I love board games. I'm like just a generalist, of course. I'll put that disclaimer out. But Kill Dr. Lucky, it's sort of like a Clue.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
That's how I'd describe it. But it becomes very, very complicated when you set up teams and it changes and it messes up the strategy. That kind of shows and reveals how I'm oriented toward board games, where I don't love the real way of playing it. I love the connection that I have with my family.
Oh, sure.
Right. Your family's specific way of playing it.
Like, we spend, have you guys heard of the game Power Grid?
No. Kat is the one who knows board games. I don't even know. Speak to me.
So, okay, Power Grid
is... She might be making them up.
Yeah, I'm totally making it up. So people who are listening, please don't call me up. No, Power Grid is this game where essentially each person has a company where you have a set of different power plants. So you can have a nuclear power plant. You can have an electric one. You can have like a wind one, natural gas. And it is like the most involved board game that I have ever played before.
Sounds
and my family,
terrible.
My family stayed up one night. We started playing at 10 p.m., which was a mistake. And we read the instructions, but I don't think we read it right because we wound up playing it until 7 in the morning the next day over Thanksgiving break.
So you have power plants.
Yeah.
Yes. And then what?
Okay, so how do I describe it? Okay, so in this one, this version of Power Grid that we played is based in the U.S. So you have these power plants that you try and set up in different regions of the U.S.
So there's a map of the United States?
Yeah, it's a map of the United States. I think it's kind of like Settlers of Catan, where you're sort of like fighting for the space in this really complicated way. And after each round, like, the different territories get more expensive to build in. I don't know. You guys should play it. We can play it. It might just take a lot.
I'm gonna pass, to reserve.
I feel like we need to have some kind of like tabletop game tournament.
I was going
to
say, I got a house. It's got a table.
It is. It's so fun and it's so involved. And there are other versions like set in Asia, I think China specifically, where because China's economy is different, the rules are different of power grid.
My this is like the most NPR board game.
I know.
I'm like shoots and ladders is crap.
I'm a little embarrassed, but
we're going to get like all of our international correspondents are going to be like, I am going to kill this game.
It is very good, and I recommend that. And I mean, I don't recommend playing it with family members if you want to preserve, you know, alliances.
Wow. This, this sounds a little bit like the, have you ever played the rail ones, the railroad ones? You have to build your railroad from like all around the country, and you can build a certain number of pieces at a time, pieces of rail at a time. I haven't played it in years because it's boring to me. But and then you have to carry, like, you get a card and you can take like pigs from this city to this other city. And then you, when you drop them off, you get X amount of money. But then you have to find something you can pick up there and take to another city. And to me, it's like the power plant game that you're describing. I'm like, it sounds smart.
Right.
Like I definitely, but it sounds like life. Do you know what I mean? Like it sounds too much. It sounds like life, the thing, not life, like the game.
Right.
Talk about some weird heteronormative.
Oh, my
gosh. I wanted to, now, I was going to say I wanted to talk about the game of life. But if you go back to that episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour that we recorded
2011,
I remember Barry was in that discussion. Trey Graham was in that discussion. I went on a whole tear about the game of life.
Well, then people can look it
and
up.
So we'll link to it. I won't repeat the whole thing about how it is basically it is everything that is wrong with the American dream.
Oh, wow.
It's tied up in this game and what it does to the expectations of children. Like at the end of the game, you've like won a Nobel Prize, you've been president of the United States, like there are not any options,
but you're not gonna repeat the rant.
There's not enough falling on your face in the game of life compared to the actual life. Kat mentioned before the way that so much of our playing of these games is tied up in our childhood and tied up in our relationship to our family. And when we were talking about cards before, like culturally in the little town I grew up, people played euchre and some people played cribbage. And both of them were too boring and complicated for me. My game that I always played with my father was gin rummy.
Oh, yeah.
And,
that was a good rummy play.
And we would just sit at the table and play it for hours. And I'm sure it is how, during some incredibly vulnerable period of my life, my father, like, got a lot of extra concentrated one-on-one time with me to make sure that I wasn't flying too far off the rails.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I remember when my father had a heart attack when he was 47 and I was 11. And the hospital was just down the street. We actually had a hospital in this little town. And I would go to the hospital every day after school and we would play rummy. Like, he was in his hospital bed, and he always used to joke that, like, he was at this terrible disadvantage because the heart monitor would show when he had a good hand. and it's interesting, like to have a memory like that, that was just a couple weeks, you know, that he was laid up. He'd had all this bypass surgery. But, like, where that card game, for me, I feel like I've never really been able to play it since. But it's so wound up in the memories of my father and of that incredibly difficult time in my life. And so I have this huge soft spot for gin rummy, but I've kind of set it over to the side and not really revisited it. When I play cards with the kids, it's much more likely to be, you know, poker or war or so.
Poker with your kids. I love that.
I play a little poker.
Love that.
Yeah, I mean, poker is the kids' mom's family. Poker is just like a huge part of all family gathering, and they always play for quarters.
Yeah.
And, you know,
played a little poker in law school. That was because of a boy. Sorry.
So cards are over there, and most of my card playing at this point is done in, you know, apps.
Yeah.
You know, in app form or whatever.
That's not cards.
But as far as board games are concerned, gather the family around and play Monopoly. And you really find out.
Why would you torture them that way?
Well, in that show 5 years ago, Trey Graham goes off on this huge tear against Monopoly.
It is, Monopoly
it's like
is trash.
Takedown.
It is. Just the source of all the
People
ills
have strong
in the world.
Feelings.
I mean, this show has captured a lot of antipathy toward Monopoly.
But it's interesting, though, like how much what you're saying about your experience with your dad is similar to what Kat's saying about her experiences with her family, in that a lot of times, I mean, I've quoted several times a friend of mine who used to say that both Nintendo and basketball hoops were invented so that men could talk about their feelings, which I think is not fair, obviously.
No,
it's
but,
not fair. But it is true that very often something that you're doing to pass the time is really a stand-in for people to spend time together hopefully a positive way, which is why it's so sad when you can't play games with people because they get too angry, which I have known people like that in my life.
Well, one game that I've trotted out with the kids a few times is Clue. Clue is lovely, right? Mm-hmm. And over time, you know how, you know, people go to garage sales and they suddenly, you know, they clean their house and they suddenly realize they have six copies
right,
of
sure,
Clue.
Yes.
I have like six copies of Clue.
One that I was trying to pawn off on you at some point. You told me that you had six copies of it already.
I do not need a seventh. But I played inadvertently, like within the last couple of years, I pulled out inadvertently one of the recent versions of Clue. They've changed Clue. And I am very get off my lawn about preserving and protecting the traditions of Clue. And this version was like, so I started to write them all down and I got too mad. It was like one of the characters was a video game designer.
Wow.
Like,
Imagine.
So much disdain.
Like, it's supposed, like, the whole fun is
nothing
the kind of,
should change.
Nothing should ever change.
Children should live my life again.
Children should live the way that I have experienced life with no improvements.
And before we wrap this up, we have to say, I mean, we are not talking here about these vast swaths of, like, the D&D world.
So
and there's so many kinds of games that exist. It's just a gigantic world, and unfortunately, we don't have a gigantic amount of time. But I hope that everybody will come and find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So stick around.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Stitch Fix, an online personal styling service that makes shopping effortless and fun for busy women on the go. Complete your personal style quiz, and then schedule a date to receive your first personalized shipment. There's no subscription required. Your stylist will send you 5 hand-selected pieces of clothing delivered right to your door. Buy what you want and send the rest back. Shipping is easy and free both ways. To get started, visit stitchfix.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week, bud?
So I've talked on this show before about slow TV.
Right.
Which is where various kind of Nordic TV stations will show you a very slow moving journey through a different place
right.
where the landscape kind of rolls past you slowly.
Or people cooking.
Or it's people cooking or knitting.
Knitting
is a really big one where you just watch someone stitch and stitch and stitch and stitch. And it's hypnotic, but you're mostly just watching the visual.
Right.
Icelandic TV released a 24-hour piece called Route One, where they are traveling through the country with very elaborate equipment to kind of present you with almost like a 360-degree view.
Mm-hmm. So it's a video?
It's like very like high-definition video.
And where do you watch it?
You can watch it online. It's streaming kind of. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
So you can get it here. You don't have to pirate some Icelandic TV station
right,
in order to get it. And I got a press release that crossed my desk a couple months ago announcing that Sigur Rós, the Icelandic band, one of my favorite bands, period, had crafted a 24-hour composition to accompany it. It's not a 24-hour performance.
Right.
It would be a lot. You'd have a very tired band at the end.
Yeah.
It has all these components of the performance that are then stitched together via algorithm to create this very cinematic, sweeping, beautiful sound.
It's 24 hours of Sigur Rós music.
It's 24 hours of Sigur Rós music accompanied by these gorgeous visuals.
Does it sync up to like what's happening on the screen?
Because it's done by algorithm, it's not like perfectly synced up. Sure. There's not enough activity. It's not like they have to sync up vocals or anything.
Sure.
You get this kind of enveloping visual experience accompanied by enveloping musical experience. And I've talked on the show a lot before about loving to have like ambient orchestral or instrumental music that can drown out the distractions in my life, allowing me to edit. I have a Spotify playlist that's like 17 hours long called Songs for Editing that I still get more positive feedback about that Spotify playlist than basically anything I've ever done.
Yeah.
If you don't want to go to Spotify and listen to my playlist, you can just go to YouTube, watch and listen to 24 hours of this beautiful scenery accompanied by this beautiful music. It's such a neat project. It's experimental and yet incredibly accessible.
And what is it called so that we might search for
it? So Sigur Rós, S-I-G-U-R-R-O-S, it's called Route 1.
Route 1. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. How interesting. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is basically the general contributions of Jessica Williams and Phoebe Robinson to WNYC podcasts in general. So earlier this year, Jessica and Phoebe started this podcast, Two Dope Queens, which I think we've mentioned on the show. And recently, Phoebe Robinson started So Many White Guys. And
a podcast stall called So Many White Guys.
Yeah. She didn't release So Many White Guys into the wilderness. I don't know what would happen in that scenario. It sounds kind of like Hunger Games.
They have chips in their ears so they can be tracked.
Sorry. Yes. So podcast. So Many White Guys.
So yeah, podcast.
Three O's, I think.
I mean, it's just really refreshing to hear them because Phoebe, she's just a hilarious comedian. So is Jessica. For the podcast So Many White Guys, which Phoebe is only on, she basically interviews people who are not white guys on it. And in a recent-ish episode, she interviews Alana Glazer, who is also the executive producer of that. And it is just, it's very refreshing and it's a good summer listen. And I recommend it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Kat Chow. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Lynn and I were having this conversation a couple weeks ago about Radiolab's offshoot, More Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah. It's their new podcast spinoff thingy about the Supreme Court. And it's actually kind of quietly a very good undercover podcast about race in general, right? About race broadly. The episode I want to shout out in particular is the one about adoptive couple versus baby girl.
Yeah.
Which is, I think a lot of people know the top line of that story and probably have like hard and calcified opinions about it. But if you listen to the episode, you will come away from it completely confounded about what the proper or just or moral disposition of this case was supposed to be. So if you remember this, there was this case a few years ago in which a woman put her child up for adoption. She was Latina. Her daughter was adopted by a white family. The biological father of that child originally signed off on the adoption paperwork, but then he sued for custody again under this thing called the Indian Child Welfare Act. She has this fascinating history that I can't really go into, but he's only a very small percentage of his actual heritage is Native American, but under that law, he could successfully sue to get her back. Is there a matter of how dark, like dark our racial history is when you have to, like when you understand why this law was put into place, but also like there's like human consequences of the execution of these things. Even the best intentioned laws has these consequences that are hard to game out.
I don't think anyone has bad intentions.
No one in the story has bad intentions, but it's a story that will make you flip about three times over the course of the episode. I was like, okay, this is the right thing to do. And no, this is the right thing to do. And then you're like, I don't know, man.
And there's a huge amount of stuff in that episode too, I think, about the difference between like doing the best thing for an individual person versus doing the best for a larger community versus the whole world. Oh, I agree with you. It's super complicated. And they originally did that story, I think, for Radiolab. I think that was the one that led ultimately to the spinning off into More Perfect. There's a bunch of good ones.
But anyway, I just want to, we say messy and complicated a lot on the Code Switch podcast, but it's really messy and complicated and we should call it.
Thank you very much, Gene Demby. I have just a very quick thing this week making me happy. And by the time you hear this, you will have undoubtedly heard about it. But I was extremely happy to hear that David Diggs, who left Hamilton a little while ago, gave one of my very favorite performances in Hamilton, although there's so many, is going to do an arc on Black-ish, which I think is great.
Oh, wow, that's what's up.
Because he's going to be Rainbow's brother. Yeah. And if you tell me that I get to watch that dude with Tracee Ellis Ross,
oh my gosh,
that is good news to me. Oh, that made me very, very happy. I really like that show. I really think it has a very interesting tone that I think you see other shows now kind of trying to duplicate, this really interesting family dynamic and kind of loose quality that they have. It's like it's the ABC comedy brand, but a little better, a little more, I think, similar to Fresh Off the Boat. They're kind of taking the tone that was developed around these shows like Modern Family and maybe doing something that to me is a little more interesting.
Like more specific or pointed? Or
yeah, a little more specific and pointed, and also just a little livelier joke-wise to me. But again, you know, Modern Family's been on for many seasons and I've kind of seen all their tricks, and I think that's also something that happens sometimes is that you start to be less fair to things once they get a little older. But anyway, David Diggs, Black-ish, good show, great dude. So that is what is making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Steven at IDislikeSteven. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's K-A-T-C-H-O-W. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's G-E-E-D-E-E-215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer, Emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In and Out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to all of you guys for being here for our special Half Class Outside Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we'll see you right back here next week.